Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
Hi, welcome to the Park Avenue Synagogue Parsha Podcast. This week, we are kicking off a summer treat. I am joined by a friend of mine, Rabbi Ethan Linden. Rabbi Linden, you want to say hello?
Hello, it's so nice to be here, to be doing this partnership with you.
So Rabbi Linden is the director of Camp Ramah in the Berkshires. For the sake of clarity, I'll call you by your first name and you can call me by mine, right, Ethan?
I think that makes sense. I can't imagine where people would be confused if we do it that way.
Yeah, that sounds right. I'm the bald one.
Right. And I'm the shorter one, in case anyone's wondering.
Okay. This friendship was born out of a real lesson to everyone, which is be careful about hospitality. Ethan, you were a senior rabbinical student my first year, and you just kept feeding me at Shabbat meals, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it was like one of those things you read about where you feed a bird and it just like keeps coming back to your porch. It was a little bit like that.
Yeah, exactly like that. You know, first, I just want to say thank you for being here and looking forward to this. Our plan, everyone, is that we're going to spend some of these summer Shabbatot when, you know, unfortunately, there is no camp, to still use the power of technology to bring a little Torah to the Park Avenue Synagogue community and Camp Ramah community, and just try to bring us all a little bit closer together.
Yeah, we're really excited to be doing this with you. We have such a great partnership in terms of campers and staff from Park Avenue Synagogue. This is a great opportunity for us to join forces, do some Torah. And I just want everyone to know that we promise that in future weeks, it won't just be two guys named Ethan doing the conversation. We're hoping to have a lot of fun, exciting guests, none of whom are going to be named Ethan. So that will be great. We will be reducing the percentage of Ethan commentary dramatically after this week.
Yeah, we were going to get Ethan Hawke, but then, you know, can't. Too many Ethans.
Yes, yes.
It's not going to make the cut. Okay, let's dive into the Torah. So Parshat Chukat that we're about to read this upcoming Shabbat begins with a tantalizing line of Torah. Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the Chukat, the rule of the Torah, Asher Tziva Hashem, and that God commanded. Right away, our setup seems to be pretty dramatic. It's almost a like record scratch, stop the press, to mix a metaphor. If you have not been paying attention up to this point, Zot Chukat HaTorah, this is the law of the Torah. But do we get, you know, don't murder, which you might think? Do we get, I am the Lord your God, or honor your father and mother, one of the Torah's greatest hits?
We do not.
We do not. Thank you. No, it continues, instruct the Israelite people to bring a red cow without blemish, in which there is no defect and to which no yoke has been tied. And it goes on to describe the process of sacrificing this completely red cow, the red heifer, the para aduma, and using the ashes of that sacrifice mixed with water to somehow undo the ritual impurity imparted by contact with the dead body. Ethan, did I pretty much sum up the way that Parsha begins?
You did sum it up very, very well. And, you know, what's interesting is I think already from the opening line, as you say, there's like a hint that something coming is going to be a little odd, right? And actually, even in the translation, which is the JPS translation that I'm using, when it says Chukat Torah, the translation they use there is ritual law, right? So there's already this kind of interpretation that's happening in that translation to let you know that, like, this is not a civil law, right? This is not a law, like you said, about murder or theft. The reality is that chukat does not really mean ritual law. They're just letting you know that this notion of like, this is a legal thing that's about to happen, but it doesn't fall into the place that we usually think of as being within the legal tradition. Although the Torah, as we know, doesn't really make those distinctions.
No. But the later rabbis will use this and this language to create two fundamental distinctions in Jewish law, the chukim and the mishpatim. Do you want to take us through those?
So the rabbis, and you know, the rabbis, I think, from this piece of Torah are going to realize that there are just some laws that are really hard to explain. Even, by the way, to insiders, right? There is, the Rashi on this is gonna say that part of this is about, you know, outsiders coming to us and saying, your laws don't make any sense. But there's other places in our rabbinic tradition where it's very clear that the rabbis aren't sure that they can even explain these types of laws to people who are inside our tradition, right? It's not just a question of Jews look weird to outsiders. It's a question of we look weird to ourselves sometimes. And so that's this category, which the rabbis are going to call chukim, which are laws that, shall we say generously, do not have a logical basis that we can figure out. Laws that if you said, why do you have to do that? Then we don't really have a good answer. And that is distinguished from mishpatim, which the rabbis are going to say are laws that sort of anybody, any society would basically come up with these laws if they had to do that old high school assignment of make your own country and start the legal process. Everybody's going to come up with something about murder and about theft. Not many people are going to come up with you have to sacrifice a red cow to get rid of the impurity caused by a dead body. The Torah itself does not actually recognize that distinction, right? There's no sense in the Torah that there's these chukim and these mishpatim and that there's laws that kind of make sense in a logical way and laws that do not. The Torah freely mixes and matches, which is, by the way, true of all, if you think about all of the legal tradition in the Torah, we make distinctions about civil laws and criminal laws and ritual laws. The Torah does not seem to make those distinctions. These are all later distinctions that are imposed on our text by the rabbinic tradition, which is really an attempt to kind of create some sort of categorization so that the rabbis can begin to explain and teach some of these mitzvot. That's even true for the mitzvot about things that you can do and things that you can't do, right? Taseh and lo taseh, you have to do this, you can't do this. These are all things that we later impose on the Torah in an attempt to make some sense out of what is, I think, can be fairly described as a kind of jumble of laws that the Torah does not necessarily seem to think of as being particularly divided by any categories.
Well, that's an interesting point that I actually heard you impose for two reasons of why we put the laws into different categories. So one I heard you say was for education. It's easier to teach if I can say to you, this is a one with no reason, this is one with reason, this is about money, this is about people, this is about God, makes it pedagogically more useful, which is interesting to me. And the other you said is just as a kind of a, to make sense of it. So I wonder, are those the reasons why we've wanted to put the laws into categories? And does that mean that the Torah doesn't care about pedagogy and sense? Or does the Torah have another reason why they wouldn't give us a more fully cooked legal code?
My sense is that the Torah does not intend to be a legal code in the way that we think about legal codes, right? I don't think that the Torah is aiming to create a sort of comprehensive set of laws that the people of Israel can follow and you know, go look up on the shelf somewhere. There's no sense that the Torah has that kind of organizing principle in mind. I don't think the Torah cares about sense if what you mean is feeling the need to justify the laws that they're giving through some sort of appeal to logic or natural law or some of the things that it, you know, other legal traditions are going to do. The Torah's organizing principle is very simple. God has the right to give the people of Israel as many laws as God chooses. And so in some sense, all the categorizations beyond that are somewhat beside the point.
So the Maharal of Prague actually makes this point that if the laws look bizarre to us, the whole point of all of them is just because God said so, right? And even writes that us obeying God's will, whatever that looks like to us, is the only thing keeping us from chaos and void. The Maharal has this famous line about at Sinai, if the people had not accepted the Torah in that moment, all of creation would have gone back to tohu vavohu.
And that's actually something he gets from the Talmud, right? The Talmud in Masechet Shabbos, I think actually does in fact say that, right? This idea that creation is dependent on the people of Israel being willing to follow God's law, totally independent of the fact that they understand why or how or the meaning of those laws. Which is why I think, by the way, the whole sort of rabbinic notion of finding tameh mitzvot, right? That figuring out what are the reasons for all the laws, that is actually a very controversial topic in our tradition. There are whole swaths of our tradition that basically say, as you just said, the Maharal would say, why are you trying to figure out why this law, why that law? That is not the point. The point is God said to do it. That is why we do it. In fact, the attempt to find the meaning behind the laws could itself be idolatrous. And of course, this is something that somebody like Yeshayahu Leibovitz takes to, you know, an extreme by basically saying, if you're trying to get meaning out of doing mitzvot, you're doing it wrong. Because if you're doing mitzvot for any other reason than to do God's will, you are making a mistake.
Just to say, it actually, the search for tameh mitzvot goes even pre-rabbinic. And Philo tries to find a reason for the laws and says that it's not but to inculcate virtue. And that each mitzvah, even the ones we don't understand, is meant to sort of educationally teach us some kind of virtue. So for those of you keeping track of home, that's Ethan 1, Ethan 1. He got me on the Maharal and I got him on Philo. So just there's going to be a scorecard by the end of the summer.
That's totally fair. And I would say I'm less a fan of Philo's philosophy than I am of his dough. So you should just go ahead and keep quoting the guy, as far as I'm concerned. So, but my question to you then, Ethan, though, is this. How realistic is it to say to people, you should do this because it's what God said to do? In other words, don't look for meaning, don't look for logic, don't look for sense, don't look for human understanding. What do you think? Is that something that actually could be a feasible, successful religious message that we're giving to people? Just do it because it's the law. Feels certainly out of step with our current moment. But I would say, you know, just to go back to something you said a moment ago, clearly it was out of step with many moments, because all the way back to Philo and probably before, people were looking for reasons, not just because we were told to.
Yeah. Look, even within the Torah itself, people are not following what's going on because they don't know why, and they don't trust the author. They don't, right? They don't just say, well, God, Moses told us, God said to do this, so we're going to do it. They rebel at every turn.
Right.
I can find the idea of obeying certain rules because God said so. While you're right, it goes against much of the sort of current time in which we live. I think it can have power. I think it can have power, especially if it's expanded to not just God said so, but this is what Jews do. And this is a reason that's been put forth by Maimonides, by many, that it's some of these laws are about distinction. They're about saying Jews, oh yeah, those are those guys who don't eat pork.
Do you make that distinction in your own religious life? In other words, between mitzvot that you observe because they make sense to you and you can logic them out, as opposed to mitzvot that you do just because God or your tradition or your ancestors or whatever it is kind of did those things or commanded those things. And if you do make that distinction, I'd be interested in knowing kind of what falls into which, and does the experience of doing those mitzvot feel different based on that distinction?
That's a good question. I would like to get to the bottom of my soul and back again in the next 5 minutes. I think, honestly, that I do make that distinction to some extent, if not consciously every day. I'm not sure that every morning when I put on tefillin, I'm thinking to myself, well, this makes no sense. And every morning then when I go to say the blessing before food, I think, well, this makes total sense as a nice intentionality moment before I eat. But I do think that in the ease with which I took on certain practices, I know, Ethan, you and I have both spoken as we are rabbis who did not really grow up in the strictest of observant homes. But so as I was sort of taking on new rules that I would learn about, and like, hey, did you know you're supposed to pray 3 times a day? Oh, no, I didn't. Hey, did you know there was synagogue on Passover? No, I didn't. I thought it was just a meal at night. So
have you heard of Shmini Atzeret?
No, I still don't really know what that one is.
I said, talk about laws that make no sense. Shmini Atzeret, you know, come on. That's, anyway, you were saying, so as you learned about these things.
So there were some that I would pick up more right away and say, yeah, that makes total sense. Like, so of course, actually Kashrut was one that to me made some sense. Why would do this? Why are people would have this wanting to be a part of an unbroken chain of history? And that one, it was easier to take on than wearing a kippah, which made no sense to me and still kind of doesn't make sense to me. And I do more out of the social reasons of being expected to, as opposed to because I find great personal meaning in donning the kippah. Don't tell your kids at camp I said that.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I wonder to myself, because both of us do come from this sort of place where we kind of made some of our own decisions around what observance was going to look like in our lives. And I think both of us had the experience also, Ethan, of kind of simultaneously becoming observant while also learning those things largely from books, as opposed to kind of from a received tradition.
Yeah.
And I do think that also has an impact on the way that you think about the kind of religious choices you make. And I think about this a lot as a parent. My kids are the same choices that I made because they're not being given those options in the same way. We are giving them as parents the observances, the mitzvot that we would like them to observe. And the questions when they come back to us, like, why do we wait 3 hours between milk and meat? What we find, of course, is that there's no good logical reason for that. There's not even really a good textual reason for that. And at the end of the day, what we say to our kids in that moment is, well, that's just what we do, which I don't think our kids find particularly meaningful as an answer, particularly in the moment when they're much more interested in having a Klondike bar after a meat meal than they are in my learned discussion about the importance of the mimetic tradition.
Well, I would always into your discussions of the importance of the mimetic tradition. So when the kids aren't listening to you, Ethan, just give me a call and we'll talk.
I will make sure to do that. I am sure you will be sorry that you said that at some point.
Ethan, I want to put the question back on you that you gave to me. So when you go about your observant life, do you think in your head about the reason for why you're doing the mitzvot that you're performing? And if so, what are the reasons that you have found meaningful in your life?
For me, I think I find the most meaning in the question of what has my people done in the past and how has that been meaningful for them? So, you know, for me, for example, when I read our rabbinic tradition or even the biblical tradition, I'm very moved by the notion that this is an effort that my people have made for thousands of years to work out how to live in the world as people who are committed to a particular lifestyle. I am very motivated by the notion that I have the opportunity, the blessing really, to enact similar rituals, similar observances, and similar approaches to that question. And I find that to be very powerful. And I understand how difficult it is to convince other people to feel that if they do not. So I don't want to be overly controversial here in our very first podcast, but if I could just say for a moment, this is my issue with the conservative movement's current stance around kitniot on Pesach. These foods that are clearly not chametz, they're clearly not really prohibited, but for many, many generations, Ashkenazim have avoided eating them. And it's true, as the tshuva said, as the response has said, that allowed the eating of kitniot in our communities, it's true that this tradition doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's true that it is not what is intended by the Torah or probably by our early rabbinic tradition. All of that is true. And to me, that is totally beside the point. The point is that our communities had a long-standing, well-established tradition that lasted for many centuries across many different places and families and communities. And to simply say, well, that doesn't really make any sense anymore, we're just going to tell you not to do it, feels to me like a very strange thing to say from a religious community that is all about doing things, at least partly because it's what we've done.
Shots fired on the Parsha podcast. That would, let's be clear, that was Rabbi Ethan Linden trashing the movement's kidney otshuva, though it's actually okay, Rabbi. You might not know because you haven't committed all of Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove's sermons to memory in the way that I have. But he actually gave a sermon specifically saying exactly that, that he agreed with the validity of the tshuva, but that he and his practice and in our community, we do not accept it. We still forbid kidney oat for precisely the reason that you're talking about. I think it's interesting that both of us, as we have spoken about what we find meaningful in our observance of the mitzvot, actually, Ethan, you kind of dodged the part of my question, which was, do you actually think about that when you're eating your matzah on Pesach or when you're doing a mitzvah? Do you have somewhere in your head, this is because I'm part of this people or this tradition, or this is that something you have at the front of your mind?
Yeah, I mean, not to sound heretical, but since I'm already trashing conservative movement Shuvot about kitniot, I'll just be honest and say that is much more at the forefront of my mind than the idea that I'm doing these things because this is precisely what God wants from me.
The place that you and I have not gone to with this is that this is about human beings forming communities with shared ritual or shared song or shared, you know, we all do this thing every time when we go into the sanctuary and it looks the same and it's makes us feel like we're part of a group, or every night in the Chadar Ochel, every Friday night, there's the same silly songs and silly moment, and it's not actually meaningful in its specifics. It's only meaningful in that it's a ritual that's performed by a group to show that they're part of the same group. It's less interesting to me on an intellectual level, though I feel it's quite powerful when we all gather together for those reasons.
Yeah, I would just say, first of all, I want everyone listening from Camp Ramah to know that I do not agree with Ethan's description of our Friday night rituals as silly. That would be quite heretical. But I do think, Ethan, other Ethan...
It's going to be brownies flying at me the next time I'm there for dinner.
That's right. I do think there's something to be said for our acknowledgement that in this moment, when so much of that shared ritual is not able to happen, I do think that's part of what people are missing. It's interesting for me, you know, I mostly get up and daven by myself. Mostly my morning prayers are done by myself because that's the way my day works and that's the way my life works right now. And for me, the kind of shared ritual experiences happen usually on Shabbat. And that's a major hole in my religious life right now, which of course is a reminder of what problematizes my notion of the things that I do because that's what we used to do. Because the reality is that I have chosen religious communities that have, at least in part, and in some significant ways, broken with the notion that we need to do what we used to do. And I'm talking, of course, about things like egalitarianism and the like, where it is very clear that the religious communities that both you and I are in are attempting in some way to balance this tension between feeling committed to a history and a tradition that stretches back millennia, and feeling committed also to the idea that the experience of doing those things is going to be different for each community in each new moment. And I think what's really challenging about this moment in all of our religious lives is we don't really have a good precedent to work from when we are separated as we are. And we haven't ever really developed in our communities ways for individuals to take hold of their own religious lives enough so that people can feel fulfilled while they are separated from each other.
I think I agree with your assessment of what's happening right now, but I do think that in a way, we actually have precisely all of the right tools for this moment. Because as rabbinic Jews, our religious life was born out of needing to adapt one system of symbols and rituals that had been destroyed in the temple into a new, more portable, more meaningful for the time system of rituals and symbols and mitzvot. And that's sort of what we've been talking about. So please God, the current situation won't lead to quite the same millennial upheaval as the destruction of the temple. Our people are missing camp for a summer, not forever. And we'll come back to the dining hall and we'll come back to the rituals. But, you know, we hear a lot of conversation about what parts of our synagogue or what parts of our society are going to make it through this, and what are we going to say we're not doing again, or we're, or Zoom Minion is here to stay, or we're going to stop Zoom as soon as we can. These are all these conversations that are happening, but in many ways, our tradition has actually given us the tools to have those conversations and refine which rituals are meaningful or which rituals are specifically not meaningful, but we're going to keep because of the cultural momentum or the religious momentum that we want them to still be there. Some things will come with us through this and some things won't, but it's going to be about meaning and it's also going to be about connecting us.
So I think that's very powerful. And I think it takes us back in some ways to where we began, which is as communities and individuals make these decisions coming out of this moment, right? Deciding, as you said, which are things that we're going to keep, which are things that we're going to do away with, which are the things that have changed us entirely, which of the things that we can't wait to get away from. In some ways, those conversations are really going to be about Tahameh Mitzvot, right? Why do we think we were doing these things in the first place? What were we getting out of these things in the first place? What was the meaning behind these things in the first place? And as we interrogate those questions, we will start to think about how our religious communities go into the future. And I think in some ways, that's the power behind the question of what is behind this mitzvah? What is behind this commandment? What is behind this observance? Because once we start to investigate those questions, then we can start to decide what are the things that we're going to carry with us and what are the things that we're going to leave aside as we move forward.
So Rabbi, we're coming to what would be the end of the first week of camp right now. And so we're going to play a quick game. And maybe we'll play this every time. So I want you to say, what is one thing from the first week of camp that you really are sad to be missing right now? And then what is one thing from the first week of camp that you are very, very glad you are not dealing with right now?
Well, those are great questions. And I think we should play this game each week. So certainly I can tell you for sure the thing that that I'm not going to be missing is the lack of sleep, which always attends the first week of camp. There's a lot going on, and camp is a place where it's totally normal to have a meeting at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I certainly am not going to miss the late nights and the early mornings. And the thing that I think I'm going to miss the most that I'm already feeling as we get here towards the end of this week, which would have been camp, is just the joy and excitement of watching kids and staff come back together after a few months apart. Now, unlike in years past, maybe when you and I were growing up, if we went to camp, you know, people didn't see each other. They weren't in contact as much. Nowadays, the reality is these kids are seeing each other. The staff are interacting during the year, but there's something special about the interaction of the people and the place. And when camp opens and the first day when kids come off the bus and they hug each other like they hadn't seen each other in 10 whole months, but you know they literally saw each other a week ago, that experience, that emotion is real. And it's something to do with the confluence of the people and the place. And what I'm going to miss the most, and what I already feel like I've missed the most, is that sense of magic that comes from the people coming together with the place and creating something that really can't be in existence anywhere else.
Wow. Well, thank you, Rabbi. That is a beautiful sentiment, Ethan. So happy to have you with us. Thank you for being here this week and for the next few weeks. We are really looking forward to learning from you and your wisdom and our other guests in these conversations that we're going to have. To the Camp Ramah, the Berkshires community, we are sorry that you cannot be together all at camp, but we are glad that you are with us and that we can be together in some way. To the Park Avenue Synagogue community, thank you for tuning in. As always, look forward to seeing you at services this Shabbat. Thank you, everyone. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.